Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Ladies and gentlemen, record geeks, retired plate spinners, and millennials who want to impress their parents with their record collections. Welcome to the Rhino Cast Podcast, brought to you by Rhino Records. Get ready for new releases, deep tracks, and conversations with your favorite artists and bands, and balloons for the kiddies. And now, your hosts with the most, Rich Mahan and Dennis the Menace.
On this episode of the Rhino Podcast, we talk with The Replacements' Tommy Stinson, along with producers Bob Mayer and Jason Jones, about the band's new box set, Dead Man's Pop.
See no wear, no pants, see no wear, no tie. Always on the ball, she's always on stride. Shut a lovely eye, big deal, you got to fly. You ain't nothing but a waitress in the sky. You ain't nothing but a waitress in the sky.
Hey, Dennis.
Hey, Rich. What are you up to?
I was about to ask you what you were up to.
What do you think I've got on my laptop screen right now?
Knowing you, it's rhino.com.
You betcha.
Why are you at rhino.com?
Why?
Tell us.
Well, because it has got everything that anybody who listens to this podcast could want. It's the place to go. In fact, you're going to tell me what I should look for.
One of my favorite things that you can do is sign up for the Album of the Day email. Rhino sends you a new album every day. It has a short essay laying out why you should listen to this album, why it's worth your time. There's links to listen on your favorite streaming platform. And then right there on that same page, there's all kinds of other albums of the day that you can check out. It's a great way to find something new to listen to. If you're like, I'm at the gym today, I need something new to listen to. What do I do? Bam, album of the day. Done deal. And then, of course, we have all the new releases coming up. It's fall. There are so many cool new releases coming out on Rhino and Rhino.com. All you rap fans out there, the Notorious B.I.G. Ready to Die 25th Anniversary 7-inch vinyl box set. It's limited edition. You got to go grab it before it disappears. How about all you rockers? We got the White Snake Slip of the Tongue Deluxe Edition, which includes, for a limited time only, the Donington Lithograph. You're going to want to grab that one. The Doors Soft Parade, 50th Anniversary Deluxe Edition. There's so much cool stuff coming. Speaking of cool stuff coming, Dennis, tell people who's on the podcast today.
Okay, get ready, boys and girls. It's the one and only Tommy Stinson. This is the first of a two-parter on The Replacements. And I will just tell you a little clue that my first question, his response to it involves a bodily part.
Well, you know, if you've seen any of the classic interviews that the guys did, you never know what you're going to get. You never know what they're going to throw at you. I can't wait to hear this conversation you have with him. But of course, the reason that Tommy is spending time with us on the Rhino Podcast is because of the new Replacements release, Dead Man's Pop. It's a 4-CD,
oh, yeah,
1-LP deluxe edition set. And it's based around the Don't Tell a Soul release. It ultimately, back when it was released, became the group's best-selling album. But they were unsatisfied with the sound of the record. They didn't really like the mixes. So what Dead Man's Pop does is they've gone back in and created a 4-CD, 1-LP set that remixes the album as the band originally intended it to sound. So all you Replacements fans that are kind of like, ah, oh, that record, I don't know. It's like, I didn't really dig it as much. You're going to dig it now because it's exactly the way the band wanted it to be. There's all kinds of unreleased tracks and a classic concert from 1989. Also on the podcast today are Bob Mayer, author of The Replacements' biography, Trouble Boys, and Jason Jones from Rhino A&R, co-producers of Dead Man's Pop.
Ain't much to look at, so close your eyes, here we go. Rain
Tommy Stinson, welcome to the Rhino Podcast.
Thank you.
Well, what do you got for me? Tell me. What are you thinking, Palio?
I'll tell you what I'm thinking. I'm thinking we're here to talk about that Dead Man's Pop box set with
Who
a ton
came
of
up
goodies.
With the name of that, by the way? Is that Bob Merritt?
I don't know.
No.
That Bob, was, did you come up with
no,
that?
No, that was Paul's original idea. That was the original album title it was supposed to be. And in fact, it was reported as such back in Spin and a couple of magazines in the day.
Wow.
If you read that sort of shit.
If you read that.
The things you learn when you watch TV.
But, you know, he told me that there was a couple of different names for that. It was at one point you're going to call it Festicle, which was festival and testicle. But the other thing, the other album name that he told me was like you guys were hanging with the Young Fresh Fellows a lot, and you guys like Tad in the band.
Yeah.
So you're going to call the album Tit for Tad.
Oh, jeez.
Cooler heads prevailed, I guess. So.
I could tell I'm never going to get to any questions here.
You're gonna get
that's
you
all
get
right,
nothing.
Man.
You get nothing,
I don't stand a chance.
Fucking nothing.
All right. So it was the end of the 80s. It was 88, so it wasn't quite the end. And, you know, no idea what the 90s were going to bring us. Do you remember by any chance what you and the gang were thinking about going in to recording this record? Do you remember anything at all?
No, that was back in the 1900s. No. I mean, you know, we were going to go make a record like we made all the previous records. And the only differentiating bit is that we started that record in Woodstock with Tony Berg. And
yeah, we're going to get to Bearsville. That's for sure.
And what they did, which was... I think it was a good plan in someone's mind, but went south real quick, was putting the Replacements in little huts in the middle of Woodstock and have us play in a dry county. Kind of wasn't really conducive.
Counterproductive.
Yeah, and I think the obvious is kind of written on the wall there, but as I say this... I mean, when you're playing Dodge Knife, you know, in a cabin in Woodstock, New York, things tend to get a little screwed up quick. And
as opposed to your other recording sessions.
Exactly. Well, we're city boys, so
well, you know, yeah.
Yes.
Putting us in the country, not so smart.
No. I mean, up to that point, basically you'd done all the records in Minneapolis and then had gone and done Please to Meet Me in Memphis. So this was... I mean, Memphis at least was kind of
a city. It's a city,
right?
You know, Bob.
There's some stuff going on there. Yeah,
there were things going on there, and I've made two records in Memphis. We'll talk about that later. But
yes.
No, so I mean, it got pretty goofed up quick. I think we lasted all of about 3 weeks.
Not
two
even
weeks.
That.
Not
no,
even two
not
weeks.
Not even that.
Weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
Thanks, Bob.
Bob, filling in the facts.
No, it was rough, and if you really have any insight into the West Coast and can call James Hetfield, he'll give you the 411 on that completely, because he likes to tell the story actually a little bit whenever he sees me. It's kind of a funny bit. He's a good gent. I like him a whole lot, but we were making record at the same time in that Woodstock Bearsville studio. We were making this one I don't remember what name of the record that Metallica.
They were making Injustice for All.
That's what that was.
Yeah. Oh wow!
Yeah. And they were totally freaked out by you guys.
Yeah, a little bit. Kind of, well, they saw us, you know, throw gallon bottles of liquor through the windows of the studio and freak out in the communal lodge, where everyone kind of got together and had food and stuff like that. It was funny watching him tell Axl Rose that story once. He was like, this guy.
You know that I stand face to face, and now I gotta take it back to back. Oh, back.
This is said to be the album the band made and intended to release. So, you know, and the sound wasn't the way that you and Paul and the gang intended. So I'm just going to get right to it. Who got in the way and why?
Oh, come on, man. Really? I got to answer that one.
In your own inimitable way.
You're going to go right for the balls, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I am.
Let me get my cup. So the idea was, I think, was just sort of, you know, we'd made some records and we got into this particular point in our career where it's like, now we got to have a radio smash at this point. That was kind of the, I don't know, the ne'er-do-wells trying to, you know, test fate, as you will. I don't think it made a whole lot of sense to any of us because we never could play the game. And so here's us, this record, when we made it, started with Tony Berg, which I didn't get. He actually ended up making a great record with, you know, Ted Hawkins years later that I really respected. But I think in general, you know, this was a record that we made like the other ones, but suddenly someone put it, and I think more in Paul's ear than mine, or Chris's, or even Slim's. It's like, this has to be the thing. So there's pressure and stuff like that. I don't really understand why that happened, actually. Now that Bob has played me the mixes of the Matt Wallace mixes, I'm like, why the hell did we ever go down this road? But, you know, the Lord Alge Brothers had they sort of had the monopoly on the radio at that point.
Yep,
and so that was everyone's going, get them to do it. That'll be a hit. Blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it was superfluous. I mean, it didn't need to happen. I mean, I think when you hear the Matt Wallace mixes, and which were rough mixes at the get-go, those were more what we were about. Most of the records we made, I mean, they kept giving us budgets to make them. Warner Brothers did, anyway, and Sire or whatever. We still were our best. We made a record in, like, a couple days, you know, and let alone spend a week or 2 weeks or spend a fucking month in fucking L.A., you do that, and you fucking screw the pooch a bit on that. and that's kind of what happened. Anywhere is better.
This record, in a way, too, like the way the songs came together were maybe different than any other record, because I think in the interim, Paul had gotten a real, like, four-track and a drum machine, and so the songs, maybe until you got to Bearsville, weren't as worked out as a band.
He got a copy of Joshua Tree? What?
Oh, boy. Wow.
Hold on. I'm kidding.
No, but it's true, because normally, up to that point, you guys would have to at least, like, work up the song.
Yeah, because it wasn't the only kind of, like, band-written song was Darlin' One.
Yeah.
Because that was kind of written during the Please Meet Me time period, like... Yeah.
No, I think, to be fair, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, Paul's songwriting, you know, advanced and became more advanced as a songwriter, to be succinct about this. Him being a songwriter, I think kind of he came better as a songwriter than we became as a band in a lot of ways. And I bet if we're sitting right here right now, he'd probably say the same thing. especially after that last comment I made. But really, I think that, you know, there's always been a bit of a rub with the Replacements a little bit. We're always, you know, fun and, you know, did our thing and we had our bits and our whole, you know, our mystique or whatever you want to call it. I think the one thing that always sort of set us apart from a lot of other bands and stuff is that Paul's a great songwriter. And as a songwriter, I think he always, you know, was looking ahead. You could actually look up the small faces and, you know, check out the same thing with Steve Marriott. I mean, same, like, he got kind of tired of the small faces when he just felt like he wasn't, like, they weren't keeping up the where he was going with things. And I think that kind of happened with the Replacements. And I think that kind of happened with this record in a way. I don't know that I think the songs are the pinnacle of our career. I think All Shook Down, I think the songs were, that record, hands down to me, is like drop dead gorgeous kind of thing. And this was leading up to that.
Yeah.
And so if you listen to the songs, and think about where that's going. You know, Paul's got a drum machine in his basement. You know, he's living in South Minneapolis with, you know, his wife at the time and all this is going on. He's, you know, getting into the place of making that last record, which was, I think, my favorite. So.
Well, actually, I want to jump in for a second. I think that part of the reason why the kind of the Chris's kind of Chris Lord Alge's production was thrown on it was the way that Warner was kind of set up at the time, where Reprise was the alternative division which you guys were kind of thrown into, and yep. They actually had a radio support system. So if they were going to try to push you guys to radio, then you kind of had to sit within what Reprise
they've been pushing
wanted.
Us since Tim.
Well, yeah, no, I know, but it's
just
like
they ain't been pushing hard enough, apparently.
Oh, well, yeah, but oof. I think that was part of the reason why it kind of moved in the direction that it ended
that actually going is
into.
That is true, because it was right around that time that they reactivated Reprise, so yeah. They're like, we'll set up this like specific for these cutting edge bands. But we still need to get them on the radio.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah.
Cutting edge bands. I mean, the Sire had already had like the Pretenders, right. And you know, go down the laundry list of bands that were on right. Sire at that point. Like, I guess we were not quite as polished as Chrissy Hynde.
'Cause they're blind, they hold you too close to the light.
This band that we're talking about has a very interesting reputation with recording tape. And you know where I'm going here. So we're all kind of sitting here because these Ampex 456s ended up in the right place. Would that be true?
You know what? There's a whole lot of shenanigans with that whole story. But
yeah, that's where we're trying to go here. So tell me about the non-shenanigans.
The non-shenanigans. Well, I have all the tapes in my basement. Warner Brothers doesn't actually have them anymore.
Yeah, you have everything.
I have them in my basement.
Yeah.
And they smell
true?
They smell like formaldehyde.
When I talked to Slim, though, he told me before I knew that he had stashed these tapes in his basement, he was telling the story of like the famous story in '87 where you guys, you know, took the tapes
water.
From Twin Tone and threw them in the river. And at the time, Slim said that never made any sense to me. I was like, if you're going to steal them, at least just steal them and hide them in the basement. Of course, when he was telling me that, I didn't know that there were these
that he
tapes
had his
like
own
a few
tapes.
Feet
yeah,
away.
Yeah.
So Slim's a. Slim's wow. a smart man.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was smarter than the rest of us, I suppose.
You inherit the earth, but we don't want it. It's been ours since birth. What you do now?
One Tom Waits, I have a question for you. Did you drink
no.
first and go to the studio, or did you go to the studio and drink first?
You guys went to dinner first.
I
didn't
think
you
went to the Formosa.
We went to the Formosa and we had snacks.
Snacks.
And snacks. And
light,
they might have been they might have been more like a, you know, more like a smoothie than actual hard food object.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But oh,
a smoothie.
I don't
like
wanna,
a margarita.
I'll be honest with you. I don't want to get too far into that either, cuz I'll tell you what. It was a very sweet moment in my memory about all of that. And Kathleen, his wife, was there and stuff, and she kind of left him with us. And that's when things got kind of interesting in a funny way. And, you know, he had been kind of in and off or whatever, I think, at that time. And when she left, we put on, you know, we put on the Mai Tais, I should say. And he was telling stories. He was hanging out with us. It was a great, great moment. And musically speaking, it took all of about a minute for Kathleen to leave and us to go back to the studio and just start putting in guitars and fucking around. And again, I have not heard my part in this scenario of Replacements with Tom Waits. I do remember a sermon about the you know, the heathen will follow the lizard and this whole thing.
That's on Date to Church, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was pretty rare.
Do you remember the remember the Billy Swan cover, I Can Help?
Yeah, there's a version of I Can
you
Help.
Guys, with you guys kept dropping into I Can Help.
Well, everything you got me, everything you were real. Baby, let me tell you just about the way that I feel. I Can Help. I'm a man and I can help. Oh, baby, I got two strong arms. I Can Help.
I hear that.
Why? That and what is that? Hey Lottie. You guys kept going into that too.
Hey.
Which is wonderful. And that did not make the box set because yeah.
No, but Low Down Monkey Blues.
Yeah, Low Down Monkey Blues does, yeah.
Got a windmill, I'm falling down, I'm a mean monkey, and I'm coming down, I'll be waiting. Waiting, baby, for you. Just a mean old monkey, I do anything you say I should do.
We were lucky enough to meet some of our, you know, some of our favorite, you know, musicians and stuff like that along the way. Whether it's Keith Richards or Terry Reid or Tom Waits or whatever. We've been blessed with that. And that's a great thing. And lucky, I mean, I sat next to David Bowie on a couch at the International Rock and Roll Awards ceremony they did one year. He just sincerely asked me questions about, how you doing? How's the tour going? How you doing? And he was very sincere and was like, great. But all that stuff aside, the Tom Waits session was like, you know, meeting someone you've only heard of before. I had no idea what he even looked like, but I'd known, you know, Martha and some of the songs that he'd written that I really loved a whole lot, and hanging out with them and his whole Tom Waitness, it's like, holy shit, man, this is a fucking heavy, and this is the guy. This is the guy, and suddenly here we are with guitars on, and we're just and hanging out playing. It was like, it was kind of a funny, in my mind, like I remember the colors and the moment of that night. I almost wish, to be honest with you, that the audio of that would have been kept in a vault, because only for this one reason, and I say this, Bob, sincerely, is that it was so special to me.
Right.
It was like one of those moments, you know, where like you're going like, man, this is, you know, there's a fucking real heavy dude right there, and I'm sitting right next to him. We're playing guitars. Goofing off, and we're having laughs, and you know, we're all a bit in the cups and all that. It was great. It's one of those things you kind of almost want to preserve and like keep to yourself in a way, and that's all I'm saying.
Well, I ain't very good, but I get practiced by myself. Forgot my one line, but I just said what I felt.
Hey, Meyer,
if only he was lonely. Only I was lonely. Only I was lonely. I'd go home with you.
There's some really special moments within there. Like I totally understand the sincerity of it's a really special, close to the chest kind of moment.
Yeah.
But within there, for me, just as Bob and myself listening to this material, one of the things that really struck me was whenever you guys are running through We Know the Night multiple times, and to hear Tom say to Paul and yourself, I really love that song, and I really love what you guys are doing. That was for me as a fan,
yeah, it's pretty cool. Fly on the
wall.
That
is a total fly on the wall. You can. Yeah. That's worth the price of admission alone.
We don't know the prime red Indian red.
Funny chorus.
And we don't know the pain of a broken day. We don't know what's wrong.
The thing that's different about this record too is, you know, you did Pleased to Meet Me as a three piece, and this is the first record with Slim.
Yeah.
And just, you know, obviously, you know, the first half of the band was you guys and your brother, and then you did this kind of one record, Pleased to Meet Me, just sort of as a trio, and then Slim kind of came in. And when you listen to, like, just listening in the car, you were saying, oh, like, I think it was Darling One or whatever. There's Slim had a kind of distinct thing that was, you know, different. So
he did. So what Slim brought to the table, which was funny in a particular way. So my brother was more of a rough and tumble guitar player. He could just rip the balls off that thing and was great at it. And Slim was more of a melodic kind of guy. And he also made his own pedals, his own, you know, chorus pedals and things like this, right? And so Paul gave him a lot of, you know, like, you know, space to just try and, you know, you know, put himself in the mix here, and to so to speak. But also, I think Paul appreciated and respected Slim a whole lot in a way that, as a guitar player and a songwriter and stuff, where I think that all came into play on this record, and that's where you get kind of the in my world, you can feel this record coming together in a way, and I hate to say it. Leading up to All Shook Down. This is like the stepping stone to that.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Banished forever from your sacred nest, on your snow white breast, I feel there's still unrest. I said, hey, darling one, your time is coming.
It's cool to hear him play because he kind of changes just the sort of dimensions of the band just because he plays, you know, he's playing with a thumb pick. He's like does his own electronics. It's like the whole atmospherics of the way Slim played, like kind of, and Slim and Paul played differently than Paul and Bob played, you know, off each other. So it's like a kind of, I don't know, it just changes sort of what the sound is like too. And maybe that's part of why the record sounds different, you know, the last
two. Totally. And there's another part to that too. It's that, there's a sort of respect for Slim that I think Paul had, Slim's way. Slim took a beating, mind you, playing with us, but Paul, I think Paul really respected his guitar playing abilities and his melodic abilities and things like that. And I think those were important. I think completely important. And I think that. They can't be understated. And this record, I think this record, this is when they're put to the test a little bit, you know?
Right. Yeah. Paulo said it was like when Slim joined the band, it would have been like, instead of like, if the Stones got Mick Taylor, as if they would have got like Carl Perkins. You know, in 1969.
Yeah.
It's like, because he was like 10 years older than you guys, even older than that than you. And it's sort of like just the whole different kind of vibe, but that's why I think the last couple records sound, you know,
that's
different.
Pretty accurate. Yeah. I mean, that's astute of him.
Tell you questions,
tell you questions,
and they're asking you a hide.
Couple of covers, Goodbye to Jane, Born to Lose, Heartbreakers, Slade. A really good rock band doesn't become a cover band. They take it and they make it their own. And that's what I hear in this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we were all, you know, kids of the 70s and the glam rock and all that stuff. All of us. Even though I'm 7 years younger than my brother and Paul, we were all about that. There's no mistaking that, like, you know, our roots are pretty well healed and all that. So the one thing that Warner Brothers Rhino hasn't put out, and I hope to God doesn't get put out again, I'll tell you right now, is when the shit hits the fan.
Yeah, no.
That is all about us being kids of the 70s and hearing a song, knowing a song in the back of our head, and knowing kind of roughly where to play it right. Without really knowing, like, the chord charts, which I just got asked for. Yeah, the chord charts for a 3-chord song. I can't even go down this road right now. But you know, we kids of the '70s that like the glam rock stuff, Sweet and all that stuff. It was a whole thing, and we could shit it's the fans. Please don't put that fucker out. But that's a culmination of where we come from, basically.
Well, goodbye to Jane. Goodbye to Jane. She's a boots, get your fences, don't care. Goodbye to Jane. Goodbye to Jane. Let your boo when you cool, but I care. She's a queen. See what I mean? She's a queen. See what I mean? She's a queen.
And I think even, like, going back to, like, the common ground way back when the band was starting for Paul and Bob, like, they had different tastes in totally. A lot of ways. But where they kind of met was Slade and Sweet and that kind of era of stuff. So it was, like, kind of the foundation of the band.
Then you got Chris Mars bringing in the Sex Pistols
right.
when Paul kind of joined the band and stuff as well. There's a whole lot of back history that's in your book, but that... I didn't tell you about it. And that other thing. But there's a lot of synergy that happens in all that is part of how we became a band and stuff like that. And it's important. It's important and it's great. And the book totally, you know, kind of captures most of that. Unless you were in the room. You know, and so my brother showed me how to fucking play Roundabout, the second song I ever learned how to play on bass. Mind you.
No shit, seriously.
Hello, kids. Try to learn that one as your second fucking song on fucking bass. Try that one. Give it a shot, will you?
Living in a jungle, it ain't so hard.
There are two discs of the complete Milwaukee Live show. Do you remember it for any reason?
No.
It was actually right after the International Rock Awards. It was like maybe 2 days after. So it was a show you did.
No.
Because you guys are totally ripping on it. You guys are totally ripping.
I mean, it's quite the show.
I think you actually say, did you see that fucking TV shitty TV show we were on?
I don't remember.
Is that why you're here?
But I hope the check's in the fucking
Well, I'll tell you one thing about that show that I captured when I was listening to it way too loud. On Here Comes a Regular, you actually hear the audience singing along. So do you ever think about how reverent the 203,000 fans you've got on that F-book thing are? I mean, not bad for an indie band.
And you're talking to someone who loves that song a whole lot. So
yes,
it's very important to me. There's a lot of songs that we've done that I'm not gonna sit here and fucking get my boo-hoo on right now. But there are a lot of songs I've always admired Paul. I've always looked up to him as a brother in a way and all that. But there are songs that are pretty fucking heavy that are truly heavy songs, and that's one of them.
Yeah.
And you have to, you know, in my position, you have to think about the content and where they come from and what that's about and where that's, you know, where that sits and resonates, you know. And some more people should hear that song.
Everybody wants to hear. You want your name out loud and clear.
the things we were listening, kind of like we were talking heavy songs, was like Rock and Roll Ghost. We were listening to the mix of that, and it's like that's like that's the thing about, I think, why the band like works on a lot of levels. Is like you could do the covers, punk covers, but you could also do Here Comes the Regular and Rock and Roll Ghost or whatever, and it was like this, you know.
Well, we were, you know, for all practical purposes, we were kind of a bipolar band. You could go, we could go from fucking full on, you know, thrown out there to like, okay, pull it back and then capture a moment. I mean, there's I'll tell you a weird story, a little quick little anecdote. I'll keep it short. Short. There was a time we were opening it for Tom Petty, and I can't remember what city it was when we did Whipping Post.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And Paul sang the balls off of it. It was ripping, and we just won it. It was fucking fantastic. It was. I just remember walking away going, we actually just played that fucking song? and for whatever reason, he just was going. He was going for it, and his fucking voice was like ripping on it. It was like, ta to the ripping part. It's a whole thing. It's like it was great. Those are the things that I always loved about my band, The Replacements.
We don't know them till we go. There's no one here to raise a toast. I look into the mirror and I see a rock and roll ghost. A rock and roll ghost.
The band is genre-proof. I mean, people, when you talk about the Mats, people are like, well, what kind of band were they? And I'm like, they were a rock and roll band. So, I mean, what do you do when people try to figure it out?
Tell them to fuck off.
Yeah, for real.
What else are you going to do? I mean, make up a new genre of like, well, no, we're not rock and roll. We're not Ameri-fucking-roll. We're not Americana fucking rock and roll. We're not...
indie
disco
or
fucking rock and roll. You can't make up a new, you know, a new idea for what it is. We're what we were.
Whenever I would describe The Replacements to any inquiring minds who wanted to know, I would say they were rippers. They either want to rip your face
that's
off
a good one.
Or rip your heart out. And I feel like that's pretty succinct.
You just don't want to do that with people that have guitars in their hands because they're heavy and they can actually bust your head open. That's the problem with that.
It's too late to turn back. Here we go. Portland. Oh no. Yeah. It's too late to turn back.
Aching to Be, should it have been a bigger hit? Was radio ready for it at the time?
No. No, radio was not ready for a fucking sensitive, pretty song. This, you know, sort of a mid-tempo kind of fucking vibe. No, not at all. Great song.
It's kind of like a poet who finds it hard to speak. The poems come so slowly, like the colors down her cheek.
Number 51 on the Billboard Hot 100, I'll Be You. Closest thing to a hit for the band?
Yeah, think about the lyrics on that one. Think about the melody and the whole thing.
Oh,
that
it's got hooks for days.
Hooks for days. Fucking days.
Hooks for days.
Look at what was also
my point.
Look at what was being spun at that same time on, you know, the fucking Billboard Top 100. Just saying.
And I could purge my soul perhaps for the imminent collapse. Oh yeah, I'll tell you what we could do. You be me for a while, I'll be you.
When you listen to this whole thing, you're going to say, like I did, wow, we were pretty good. We were decent. What does this all add up to? Because this is a repurposed, this is the record that supposedly, you know, tapes are stolen and there's all this stuff here. I mean, there's 60 friggin' tracks. That's a
also,
lot.
Well, also,
you wait, wait till the next one.
Yeah. Also, more than decent, fucking amazing.
Bob Mary, you're still on the hook, fuck.
Next one. No.
I tell you what, to be really honest and frank about this stuff, I respect my legacy. I've got a 29-year-old daughter that wants to, and she's a great singer, great songwriter, and a whole nother genre, she's a millennial and all that. And so I have to step back a little bit from this stuff a little bit and let her know I'm maybe one in a million, maybe one in 5 million that's been as lucky as I've been to have done this. Whether you're ever going to hear that from fucking Paul or my brother's dad, you know, rest in soul, but or Chris Mars, the reality is we've been lucky enough to have been here and done this, and we did a thing, and I'll take it a step further. Minneapolis was a particular thing back then that was a scene that I have never seen before or after, and I lived in L.A., you know, from 93 on for till 2008, it's a big deal. It's a big deal to me. It means a lot to me, and I respect it completely and wholly. And I would just hope that the kids that want to, you know, learn how to play music and stuff like that, they would check out that moment in time, kind of like the hardcore moment in time in L.A. where there was X and Black Flag and all those. That was a moment in time as well. We were around in that scene when we started, and we've just been lucky enough to have done all that we've done, and while we're talking about this goddamn record right now, and
you're just
and appreciating it. And I tell you what, I appreciate my legacy like nobody in the band. You got Chris does his thing, Paul does his thing. Anytime I got an interview with someone, I got to talk to someone, I'm gonna tell you right out of the gate, I appreciate and respect where I came from. But we don't want it. Laying claim at birth. When the wind cries for help and you're done dying on it. We'll inherit the earth. But we don't want it. What will it be worth when you're still on it?
Well, all you Replacements fans are definitely going to want to check out Dead Man's Pop. It's the 4-CD, 1-LP deluxe edition set. It is out now. If you get one of the earlier versions, there's a cassette release that's included with it. Very cool stuff from the Replacements. And all of you fans who are disappointed with the way that Don't Tell a Soul sounded when it originally came out, you're going to love it now. It's the way the band originally intended the album to sound. Tack on all the bonus material and the live show, and you can't lose. Thanks very much for tuning in. Don't forget to listen and subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss the next Rhino podcast. Executive producer for Rhino Entertainment, John Hughes. Produced for Rhino Entertainment by Pop Cult and Rich Mahan Promotions. All rights reserved.